saving money on all your electrical needs at Menards. From wire, tools, testers, and more, Southwire is the perfect choice for your next electrical project. They offer innovative products to help you get your project done right. Hurry in today and save big on all Southwire products at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at Menards.
Hello and welcome to the Undercut Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jesse Billington, and we're back to review the seventh race of the Formula One 2024 season, the Imola Grand Prix, we'll use the short name for it. And to do this, I'm joined by Mr. Timo Albus Daly. How are you?
Very well, thank you, Mr. Jesse Billington. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty well. Found out across the weekend that I am not fit enough to join the Special Forces, and I don't do well when electrocuted. I tend to black out, so yeah.
You had to test yourself for these? I could have told you it was for free before the weekend.
I did a tough matter with my brother-in-law. It's, one of the strange things we get up to because we're essentially not very bright, so subjected ourselves to that, but did also get to enjoy the Monaco Grand Prix and qualifying for the Indy 500.
I think you did watch the Monaco Grand Prix. I think it's probably Imola.
I'm a week ahead.
The electricity really got you, didn't it? How high was the voltage?
I don't want to ask, don't want to know. It's Fritz something in my mind. But yeah, Imola Grand Prix and Indy 500 qualifying. I'm getting too ahead of myself. I'm excited for Indy 500. My brain's immediately gone. Indy 500 must
That's
also
be
Monaco.
That's how good the Imola Grand Prix was. Already looking forward to the IndyCar racing this weekend.
Yes. Yeah, I think I'm right in saying that Andrew Benson, BBC sports reporter, described it as soporific, which is a great phrase, meaning tending to induce drowsiness or sleep. And I thought that's a great way of certainly describing the first 7/8 of the Grand Prix, at least.
Yes, very much so. I think it's unfortunate, but luckily before we fall asleep, more can we review it. There are a few bits of news, which include some feeder series news, which, ironically enough, considering I'm the guy that's normally across all the feeder series stuff, you came across this before me and are a bit more dialed in with it, so go for it. What's been going on and why?
Yeah, I sort of stumbled across this one. It's quite interesting. Essentially, Solov and Stenshorn in the Formula 3 series have been disqualified from the Spa and Silverstone rounds, respectively. Solov is...
Bear in mind, they've not happened yet, just
those
in case
rounds
people
haven't
are wondering.
Happened yet. Yes, they've been preemptively disqualified. They will be barred from taking part in the event. Solov is the Alpine Junior. He raced in Euro Cup 3 at Spa ahead of the Formula 3 calendar reaching the circuit this year. Given the similarities of the cars in F3 and Euro Cup 3, combined with not asking the FIA for permission, it's been deemed that this has given Solov an unfair advantage going into the Formula 3 round in Belgium later this year, so he's been made to sit it out. Galling, considering he retired from the only competitive session in the race weekend in EC3, so it isn't likely he's learned much. He's likely also to retain his seat in the series, though, and will race again in 4 more rounds at Portimao, Zandvoort, Jerez, and Barcelona, though none of these precede Formula 3, so he's fine there. It won't sort of give him further clashes. I think Barcelona and Zandvoort would be the only ones that have a clash at F3.
I don't think Zandvoort go there. I don't think they go to Zandvoort this year.
No, so it's only Barcelona that would be a problem. When it comes to Martinez Stenshorn, the recently announced McLaren rookie has fallen foul of very much the same issue, but has taken part in GB3 at Silverstone. So same problems, same result. And equally, Arvid Lindblad has done similar, but having only done GB3 testing at Silverstone, this being a sort of a non-competitive session, means he's only been hit by a financial penalty. So it's very interesting that this is the first time we're hearing of this sort of clash and this rule, but it does raise a few questions beyond Formula 3 as well about other drivers double-hatting it in seasons, namely Dorian Pan and Abby Pulling, who are currently both doing Formula 1 Academy, and in Pan's case, Frecca, and for Pulling, British F4. Certainly for Pulling, where F1 Academy and British F4 are both classified by the FIA as Formula 4 class, this might be an issue. Pan should be okay because Frecca falls under the F3 category, so she's essentially allowed to step between two without it being an issue. Similar to Behrmann, if he wanted to, could have run an F2 and F1 in Saudi because they're two different clades. There's not really a clash. It doesn't give you an unfair advantage. The argument being you'll know the track, but you won't know how a car of that specification will behave. So, yeah, it's an interesting one to see how this develops further. And equally, sort of whether this impacts sort of drivers doing more and more series at once, which is something we've sort of started to see, certainly in the lower formula, with the likes of Formula One Academy, with drivers sort of doing two or more at once.
This is where I want to go back to a specific thing you were reading out there from why this was happening in the first place, because it was all about permission. They didn't ask permission to go and do this. So that makes me think, is this just more the principle at play here rather than anything else? That if you come and ask us nicely, we'll think about it, we'll look into it, and because you've come and done it and you've asked us nicely, we'll let you go and do it. Because like you say, the Formula 4 stuff, if you look at the Alcobaça sisters, they do a lot of stuff they did in Winter Series, but again, and they've been doing some stuff in the Middle East generally with Formula 4. But again, it's on tracks that F1 Academy aren't going to this year. So where's that balance there? But also, is it just the act of getting permission and just showing that you know what the rules are? Because I'm curious as to how we've not seen this before. Is it because it's just bad policing or just common sense from team and drivers before now to check these sorts of things? Because it seems like that kind of rule that you would have that one person in your team who's just, there's always that one person who knows everything. You think Clarkson's farm, his farm manager, he knows every single thing that Clarkson needs to know on a farm that he wouldn't even know how to find it, so that he doesn't make these mistakes that he wants to. You need one of those in your team.
Yeah, they need sort of a cheerful Charlie. Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, because Stenshorn's comes despite the fact that he was apparently racing for High Tech in GB3, so surely High Tech as an organization would have known
that's why
that.
It's interesting.
And yeah, sort of the work that went on afterwards said that there hadn't been neither the competitor nor the driver requested written approval from the promoter, as requested in Article 10.4e of the sporting regulations. And the driver of Car 15, Stenshorn in this case, explained that he was not aware of the requirements of Article 10.4 and that both the activities, the test, and his participation in the GB3 event were organised by his management team, which is all road management. I don't know who else they manage, but yeah, you'd thought it was a management team.
With Abby Pulling, it's the interesting thing, because you're saying she's the one you're most worried about there. And whilst I think the distinctions being made and how fine the margins are would be good to know, I think the key bit here is not just the permission, but it's where they go and how the hierarchy fits. Because if Formula 3 went there, say Formula 3 went to Spa and then the Euro Cup or whatever, they go after that, would it be okay for him to have competed in the 3 and then go there? Or and it's not allowed, vice versa? Because I'm probably GB4, I don't think F1 Academy even go to Silverstone this year. So in theory, there shouldn't be any crossover or anything. So she'll gain more experience, but she won't get experience at the tracks that they're going to. So it should be okay.
Yeah, F1 Academy not at Silverstone this year. So I think because there's not a clash, there won't be an issue there. And equally,
that's how I'm reading it.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Equally with Solov, obviously with them going to Barcelona later in the year for EC3, he should be
able to
on
it by then,
because F3 would have already been there. So the higher ranked series within the Formula 3 group won't be sort of deemed to have gained too much of an advantage, and vice versa. So yeah, I think there's sort of, you get your F3 group of series and then you have a hierarchy within that group, in the same way that with you sort of see F3 as being a little bit above Freca, and then obviously that's still in itself probably above Euro Cup 3, and then you've got sort of your F4 groups where you've got things like F1 Academy, which is possibly seen as above British F4.
Which is why I think if you're going to be one of these drivers who's competing, say, in F1 Academy, but then you want to do F4 Italy or F4 Spain or F4 Middle East, it's all alright, because with so few rounds in F1 Academy at the moment anyway, and because there's such a vast variety in where they're going, you could choose, say, all of Spain and just skip the Barcelona round if they go there, or just skip the Qatar round if you're in the Middle East, but you can still do everything else, and it's just playing that nicely. But again, it shows how these fine margins work. And then it's interesting that if that is how this works, because that makes sense from what we're seeing here, then for these drivers in particular to slip up on that, is then it feels a little bit of, it goes from, we've had this really finicky little rule, that's just common sense, how did you not figure that out?
All of these seem to be sort of coming down to administrative errors, and it's this not asking permission or miscommunications, which is strange, and a lot of it seems to come down to a power to weight ratio rule as well, which is sort of what generates this hierarchy. It's a power to weight ratio of 2 kilograms per horsepower or less. I think the Taltus MSV002 chassis produces 250 brake horsepower and has a weight of 608 kilos inclusive of driver, while the modified F3 T318 used by Eurocup 3 produces more horsepower but also weighs a bit more. So it's strange. Also, this is a rule that hasn't really been excluded. It's seen in its use since a driver was excluded in 2019 for this rule, this reason. So it's quite interesting, sort of how it's reared its head. And
I'm just loving the links that we go to on a Grand Prix that was not that interesting to really dive into the details of something that hasn't been in play for a good few years now.
Yeah, I mean, interesting. Mary Boyer did this last year. He did F3 and Eurocup 3, finished second in the latter series despite missing Aragon to take place in to race in Formula 3's Monaco event. So perhaps
suppose it's doable, but you know what the either you got permission and it's okay, or he knew where he was going before he was going there in the higher ranked category, and it's just this common sense thing of just check your calendars.
He made appearances at both Spa and Italy's Autodromo Nazionale Monza months prior to Formula 3's respective visits there, but he had received formal permission to do so. So this really is just the FIA having a bit of a hissy fit for not being asked about something.
It feels like the mafia kind of thing of like, why did you take money from our area? You didn't ask permission. If you asked permission, it would have been fine, but now we've got to do something about it.
Yeah, it just seems a little bit unfair that in reality, had they asked permission, chances are it would have been fine.
Is it unfair though?
I mean, rules are rules. You've got to follow the rules is sort of the argument.
You're just proving you and your team couldn't read a document.
Yeah, it worries me that they're not following. If they're not looking at those rules, what other bits are they possibly not reading, looking at, trying to skirt around?
This is a good segue though into the next news piece, because I can go and say about you should really always read the fine print, which Bottas should do regardless of where he gets a contract for next year, if he gets one at all.
Yeah, so we'll move on from the rules and rules of engagement for Formula 3 to rules of engagement when it comes to seats and contracts in Formula 1. And Williams and Alpine are both reportedly looking to sign Bottas. Obviously, for Williams, this means no Logan next year because they've already confirmed Alex, but also no Kimi Antonelli, no Fred Vesti, and no Mick Schumacher. For Alpine, it then begs the question, who's off? There's early rumour of Gasly to Williams. Ocon has the rumour of Mercedes following them about too. But equally this evening, there's been news coming out of the paddock that he could be going to Haas to sit alongside Ollie Bearman, which would be a very interesting prospect.
Ocon or?
Ocon.
Right.
Ocon to Haas, which is, I mean, Haas are doing better than Alpine, so
it's interesting you're saying this, because I would say if Bottas went to Williams, 1 year contract would make sense there, because they've got a few people coming up through the lower ranks and you'd want to put them in the car, and Bottas, it's a good way to measure if he's still got what it takes in some ways, and if he's actually, because he's had a nice career. But let's say, and even with a bad car, he's not outperforming what he should be at the moment. Mm. So this 1 year in hopefully a better car would be great to measure what he's like, and you can take it from there. Alternatively, you saying about Ocon to the Haas there, what about Bottas to Haas for a year or two if K-Mag doesn't improve over the course of the year? Because we've seen Hülkenberg have this massive hiatus and then come in for the last couple of years and just be absolutely on it. And K-Mag, aside from that excellent finish in Bahrain straight away when he came back, it's been a bit hit and miss. And I also wonder then, if we're going to bring Alpine into it, Gasly's voiced his unhappiness with Alpine, unsurprisingly, lately. Maybe he goes to Williams instead of Ocon goes to Mercedes, or vice versa, and you've got a whole open field there for the French outfit.
Okay, consider this. Bottas to Williams, he does a year there as sort of like a car development and helps the team get set up when it comes to building and sourcing out cars ahead of them moving into the 2026 regs. So whatever new team James Vowles has built up is a good team. James and Bottas have a good history together. It makes sense to build it up. Equally, Bottas used to be at Williams, so he's going back to a team that he knows
full circle and
can help just sort of shore things up as he leaves the sport. Then it means that whatever Williams wants to do, have they got drivers in F2 at the moment, Williams?
Colapinto, I think.
Yeah, so if Colapinto is ready, he's got the chance to go for 2026. That means they can give Colapinto another year of maturing in F2, move Colapinto up.
And they've got Zach O'Sullivan in there as well, I think.
This is true. Yeah.
So there's a couple of drivers there where they've got options where you maybe want a year or two in F2 to make sure that they are the genuine article.
Yeah.
And like certain other drivers, but that's another separate thing.
That makes Bottas to Williams make sense. But then that still leaves Ocon and Gasly sort of floating around. Ocon to Haas, I can sort of see happening. I don't think Mercedes are going to go for him. Although if they do, it would be one of the tallest driver lineups on the grid, Ocon.
I also think it's going to be difficult at the moment getting anyone in that Mercedes willingly for a one-year contract because they seem so hell-bent for some reason, which we'll discuss in a different episode on getting Antonelli into that Mercedes, that they're all going to go, well, if we can't get him in next year, we'll get him in for 26, which means whoever goes there is going to be on a one-year contract. And you've got to be a hell of a driver to then get them to go, no, you're going to give me at least two. And unless you're signed to Verstappen, I don't see that happening.
Yeah, it's an interesting proposition. The other argument, though, with him going to Mercedes is, does he want to go to Mercedes? A team that Fred Vasseur, someone asked Fred Vasseur after the Grand Prix, oh, do you think Mercedes are sort of closing up to you?
And he said,
yes, certainly this weekend they were 26 seconds behind off the back of us, so they're getting closer. I'm like, that is... while it's cheeky from Fred Vasseur, it does raise a good point.
True.
Yeah, Mercedes are a long way off the pace right now. Yeah, there's a step forward from Alpine, but equally it's not where you want to be making quite the step forward to.
And also pretty much any team is a step up from Alpine at the moment.
Yes, yeah, bar perhaps Williams. So yeah, it's an interesting one for both the French drivers at the team. Though if they do both leave, I think they have Alpine have the strong option of Doohan and who else did I say was touted? Kushmini or possibly Schumacher, because obviously he's in their endurance series.
All of those, as long as they actually have a car that works.
Yeah, I did see it. Let me just pull it up. I did see it and read about it earlier. What was it? Yeah, that was it. Yeah, Nick and Doohan to Alpine with Ocon having Behrman, his teammate at Haas. So there's some interesting stories kicking around. Still leaves Gasly unaccounted for. I can't see him going to Mercedes. Sainz could go to Mercedes. I would like to see him go to Red Bull. I think that his sort of teammateship with Verstappen has patched up since their days in Toro Rosso. So I think that could work.
Sainz to Mercedes and Gasly to Aston Martin. There we go.
Then that leaves Yuki Tsunoda with... What do we do with Yuki Tsunoda?
You can go up to Red Bull if you want.
True. It's all getting...
Give him a season in the top car and see if he's any good, and if not, Ricardo's there waiting again, so it's all good.
You've always
got another Red Bull driver.
It's always getting very confusing, but ultimately, I think I'm going to play devil's advocate. We're going to be very disappointed when very little changes bar Hamilton to Ferrari or something. And that's going to be it. That's what we're really going to see.
Alpine stays as it is, K-Mag stays as it is, and
K-Mag stays, continues committing terrorism every weekend on the drivers around him, and nothing changes. It'll be quite a dull result afterwards. But one of the big
something that was a nice change though this weekend was someone who wasn't Crofty in the commentary booth for Sky F1, because it was friend of the podcast Harry Benjamin, and whilst it wasn't perfect, it was a very solid debut from him and definitely took charge as a lead commentator, and it was just nice to have someone different, wasn't it? I mean, he was kind of thrown in the deep end a little bit because this was quite a boring Grand Prix, but he was able to fill the airtime and we weren't falling asleep because of his commentary. So if you can do that straight away, that's good.
He wasn't making mistakes through his commentary either. We weren't getting sort of the crafty blunders coming in there either, which was quite good, especially considering he didn't actually fit in the commentary box. I don't know if you've seen any of his pictures.
He's quite a tall man.
I think he's 6'8". He's a lot taller than I am. And there's a great photograph of him next to Karun. They were obviously on commentating duty. And he fills the commentary box. And there's like the emergency overhead light, and he has to sort of duck to get under it.
If he does it again, they should get him in the Pope-mobile. So it's a little box off the top of it, so we can see what's going on.
But yeah, I think he also, like many commentators, enjoys commentating while standing up. So in a very small space on your first
Grand Prix. It was his own fault, really, that he can't fit
in. Yeah, it's interesting circumstance, but a welcome change, certainly. But anyway, we'll dive into the Grand Prix. And we'll kick off with, of course, qualifying. Verstappen equaled Senna's record for 8 consecutive poles, and he had to fight for it. Big celebrations for him, clearly still into the sport and the challenges it poses. So it's nice to see him really still engaging with F1 and having to occasionally put up a fight. He did speak highly of Imola as a circuit as well, which is quite nice to see. Sort of, he enjoys it, and he says it'd be great if we could have sort of just a calendar that's 25 Imolas. I was like, it'd probably get a bit boring. We'd like a bit more overtaking, but
just when I start warming to him a little bit, he says some stupid stuff like this, and I go, next.
I think his argument is more that it's very much a driver's circuit, and one where you have to be on it. You can't just use the tarmac runoffs with the gravel all around it. It's very old school. I think that's more what you're saying, more so than the narrowness.
It's one of those things where I'll just say it now and get out of the way. I do quite like Imola as a circuit. I just really don't like it for Formula One at the moment.
Yeah, if you watched it for WEC, it was pretty good with WEC. But
just the cars are too big with F1, and you can't, like you say, like Oscar was saying, aside from the DRS straight, which was shorter for some reason this year, there is really no way you can do anything too much unless you're making some ballsy moves. But even then, it takes you a while to try out which way is the best way to go about it. I think you saw that with Yuki on someone, and then Hulk got past that same driver immediately the next lap, because you're like, oh, this is a perfect place to do it. I'll just copy that. Thank you for working it out for me. I can just go and do this now.
Otherwise,
you're just kind of trying what other drivers have tried the last few years, and then you see like a Sainz Ricciardo from 22, and that doesn't go.
No, I think it was Yuki on Logan that was really close moves from Yuki. And actually a really good sort of sign of skill from Logan. The car really isn't there, but he was putting up a bit of a fight. Piastri was penalised coming out of qualifying for holding up Magnussen, which was a little bit unfair. It's such a narrow track, it's tricky to try and get out the way.
I also don't think it was the worst kind of obstruction we've seen for that either. So it's quite frustrating. I think it was Ricciardo earlier in the weekend or later in the weekend, I'm not sure, but he impeded someone, but he only got a financial fine. So I'm intrigued about why it's one thing for this and then a different thing for another, you know? So it's like, is it the qualifying, it's a fine, and then afterwards it's grid penalties, or is it just we really don't want Piastri to do well?
It's a bit of an odd one. But yeah, suffered a 5-place grid drop for it, but still performed quite well during the race. We'll get onto him in due course. Ultimately, though, it was a bit of a dull race, and further proof that, as we've already mentioned, the modern cars are too fat in width and curb weight to be any fun on these narrow circuits. And I'm really hoping I'm proved wrong on that sentiment when I'm in Hungary later this year, which is also famously a street circuit without the walls. It is very narrow, very tight, very twisting. So we'll see what happens.
There are some more spots where you can overtake there, I feel like. It feels like here you could only really do it properly.
Going into Tamburello.
Or along the start finish straight if you're close enough.
Rivazza,
not really. Whereas Hungary, you've got the start finish straight, you've got turn two, you've got turn one, you've got turn 3-4-ish, I think, a little bit, and then a couple of bits later on, you can kind of just if you're close enough. So whereas here you're like, you can get close, and you saw a couple of people trying or looking, but were never able to make it past.
Let me just try and check my circuit map for Hungary. Yeah, you can sometimes get lucky if you get a good drive out of turn 11 at Hungary on the straight run down to 12. It's the tight right-hander. You can sometimes get someone on the brakes there.
Ricciardo late on the brakes going.
Or you can get around the outside and get inside for 13 and just hope you've got the distance on them for 14, the final sort of curving hairpin. It will be an interesting one to see. But what we did get, however, was, of course, Lando Norris coming back into things very late in the day, and a great chase down to the end. We saw a fantastically close finish as well, Max being just 0.725 seconds ahead of Lando. And it was great seeing Max having to use up his battery. He was down to 30% battery by coming across the line. Lando on 70, clearly had done well to sort of save it up, was recuperating charge well. And we sort of saw him drop back at one point. I think he was just cooling the tyres, charging the battery and going for one final push. Very much akin to sort of last lap Lando in Austria many moons ago. Really interesting racecraft for him to see. But it begs the question, when was the last time we saw a race finish that closely? And I've dug back through the data. If you go back to the start of the season, the gap between Max ahead of Perez was 22.457 seconds.
It's not good on Perez, really, does it? When you
not really. Yeah, you came second.
He's already had a bad weekend, and then you go, also this.
Yeah, you started off the season about a third of a lap behind your teammate. Now you finished off P8, well done. Saudi, Max was ahead of Perez by 13.6 seconds. Australia, Sainz ahead of Charles by 2.36 seconds. China, sprint, Max ahead of Lewis by 13 seconds in a sprint. China Grand Prix, Max ahead of Lando by 13.7 seconds. Miami, sprint, Max ahead of Charles 3.3. Miami Grand Prix, Lando ahead of Max 7.6, then of course you get to Imola, which closest race finish of the season so far. It's been 19 races since we saw a finish margin inside of a second. The last was Singapore, Norris 0.812 seconds off the back of Sainz. Australia 2023 is technically the next closest result, but that was sort of finished under safety car. Canada 2022 is the next race to have a sub 1 second gap between first and second, which was just after to Sainz.
It does kind of reinforce the argument that I definitely keep making, if no one else does, that these new rules really aren't working, are they? Because closer racing, and then you've got to go back and you can maybe get 5 Grand Prix at most since these regulations began for this closer race to actually impact first and second, which is where we actually give a shit about it.
Barely 5, because the next closest race result, you have to go as far back as 2022 Saudi GP, which was the second race of the season in the calendar with the
and
new
the
cars.
The reason it wasn't Bahrain was because Max and Checo
retired.
ENF'd to the end. So that was Bahrain.
Yeah, and it was Saudi where Max finished just 0.0549 seconds up the road from Charles. That was a really good race because it was a sort of all race long ding dong between Charles and Max. But yeah, you've got to go back nearly 2 years of the sport to find the next closest race finish. And one of the ones in that gap was under safety car. So it's not great
for
the.
If it's in the sign of things to come, then I'm all for it. A one off at an otherwise dull track is not going to be enough of this. And got a little bit more on this with Piastri later, but it's kind of, I want to be optimistic, but considering what we've just talked about, I'm not. And Monaco is one of those Grand Prix where it could happen, but for a variety of different reasons that are not competitiveness. So in what we've got after that, Canada, that's one where weather maybe comes into it. But again, I think if we can have another clean race as such like this, then that's going to be interesting. And I think Spain's probably the next realistic opportunity to see what we can get from this one and Canada. See if this is a one-off or if this is actually maybe we're getting something finally.
Yeah, Monaco will be tricky to predict, but Canada, I reckon we could see both McLarens finishing in very tight formation near the Red Bull. I'm going to say near the Red Bull. I don't know whether it's going to be ahead of, behind, sandwiching, or quite what orientation, but I'm keeping it open that it's going to be Max and possibly the two McLarens very close behind or ahead or around. We'll wait and see. Anyway, the details of the race out of the way. We'll jump into sort of picking apart how the teams and drivers performed across the weekend. We'll lead in with Red Bull and Timo. You might have a bit to say about them this week.
Yeah, which both good and bad, because I mean, Ricardo Montoya outdid Perez in qualifying, and Perez couldn't get past the Japanese driver in the race. Oh no, he did actually in the end, but it took him a while and kind of was more not bad strategy from RB, but just kind of the bare minimum you expect from Red Bull to get past what is still essentially the sister team. And yeah, it was just kind of very bizarre to see, because it seems so voodoo-like that ever since Adrian Newey announced that he's leaving, Red Bull has started to not do so well. And it's, again, interesting that it's Perez rather than Max. I mean, Max obviously struggled over the weekend, but he was still able to pull it out of the bag when he needed to and when it counted. But Perez, he's obviously really wanting to sign a contract to renew at Red Bull as soon as possible. Christian Horner said he's not in any hurry. And if Perez is in danger, he's certainly not behaving in the right way when he needs to make sure that he can shorten the length of time before he gets pen to paper, at least if he can't make it now. He needs to be getting that as soon as possible, and this isn't helping that. On the flip side, though, to lead into something you want to say, it's good to see Verstappen fighting for a win. Weirdly, I'm glad he did win, because it reinforces him as a driver rather than just being a statement that the car is just good. And if Norris had beaten him, yes, it was a slim margin, but it was good that Verstappen kind of had to try a bit harder than we're used to him seeing. And it's this sort of thing of, we've talked about what does Verstappen have left to prove at this point. And possibly nothing. He's not interested in records too much, really. He likes that he's equaling them or beating them or setting new ones, and that's great. But this shows that he's still hungry for it, and it's this sort of thing of like, what do you do it for? What's the point of it? What do you, when you've got past a certain point? And a little bit like when he was challenging Lewis in 2021, he'd like, why is Lewis continuing after that? It's because there's a new challenge now, there's something different, and you've got this top of the thing, but there's a new mountain over there, you can go for that. And you saw some of these Herculean drives in a way from both of them in 2021. You look at Brazil in particular for Lewis, and just just everything about that whole weekend for him, like everything was stacked against him, and he still managed to get through it all. And you think that, oh yeah, it was the car, but you can bet your bottom dollar you stick most other drivers in that car and they would not have been able to do that. And you see that with Perez win in Red Bull so consistently. So to see this with Max now, it's quite nice. And I still don't think we're going to have a championship fight in our hands. It's still too early to say anything like that, but it's just nice to see some chinks in the armor. But as to what's causing them, not quite sure just yet. Maybe the other teams are actually just improving for once in the last 2 years.
Yeah, it's sort of the closing up of the regulations as the teams grow to better understand them. Certainly, we're seeing that with Ferrari and McLaren. They're closing up to Red Bull. They're both closing up at different rates, at different times, at different steps with their sort of upgrades and their upgrade relevancy on different circuits. But equally, we are seeing, especially the gulf between Verstappen and Perez is the one that's telling us that, yeah, Verstappen is getting good regardless of the car. And that's where it's starting to show up. And that's sort of almost sort of backdated justifying a lot of Verstappen's achievements to this date, where we've seen him certainly romp away in 22 and 23 to victory over a championship. You look at that now and go, ah, no, that makes sense. Yeah, he had a great car, but that was the reason he was pulling out the sort of 20, 30, 40 second gulfs we were talking about when it comes to sort of race finish bit distances. But yeah, Max being pushed to the limit with this one was great to see. And running in a 24-hour Nürburgring sim race the night beforehand as well. Yeah, Perez proving that against a competitive field, there is certainly a bit of a gap between him and the top drivers as well. I think this is the beginning of the end for the Mexican driver when you look at his ability. Certainly going through qualifying as well, the fact that he wasn't able to make it into Q3, but you look at drivers, and it's weird to say Hülkenberg and Tsunoda in there, but also Sainz, Hamilton, Russell, Leclerc, Norris, Piastri. They're the ones you're really expecting in there, and you're expecting Perez to be up with them, but he just wasn't.
Well, again, it's this weird thing of Perez is this ridiculously experienced driver, and yet the people beating him are a guy that, okay, yeah, is a McLaren, but look where they were this time last year in his second season. Both RBs, regardless of who they are, the fact that that team is beating you is not on. And then these two flawed, shall we say, Mercedes, and they're all just comfortably ahead of you, and you're not even that far off the people behind you in Q2. That is worrying. Yeah, yeah, maybe it's just a one-off. Maybe it didn't. We saw that the team had a lot of trouble over the weekend, and maybe it's just a track that doesn't suit them. But considering how good they were here last year...
No, year before.
Last
time. But yeah, I think Perez didn't, to be fair to him, Perez didn't have a great run in qualifying. He was sort of running counter to the flow a bit. But even then, there are certain aspects that you need to be having.
Which again is even telling of itself, because you'd think the team would be on top of that.
He needs to be having these conversations with his race engineer, his performance engineer, to sort out these things before going out on track. And you look at the conversations that Max has with GP, for example. You look at the conversations across this weekend alone that Charles was able to have with his new race engineer, Bozzi. The differences, the communication. You rarely hear Perez on the radio to his race engineer, Brad Bird. And even then, it's sort of usually something instigated by Perez. Brad, I don't think is the right, not Brad Bird, that's the director from Incredibles again. I'm getting the two confused, but Hugh Bird possibly. But regardless, the conversation isn't there between him and his race engineer, and that's starting to be a bit of a flaw and a hindrance to him through the seasons. And if that continues, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Definitely, but it's kind of, Ferrari is in this weird situation counter to that, where I don't have too much to say on them, so I still feel like I'm disappointed, but not for bad reasons. It's just that we've come to expect more of them now, so that when they're not reverting back to what we've seen from them in recent years, they're just still doing a solid job, and they're kind of a higher version of Alonso this year in some ways. Mm. We'll pick and choose our battles, and this one we can't really do much with, so we're just going to keep it solid and just absorb the pressure from behind and not really have too much to talk about. But at the same time, they still managed to achieve a first Ferrari podium at Imola since Schumacher in 2006, which I know we haven't been there every year since then, but that is still ridiculous.
It's a nice chance to sort of finally broken that duck and gotten that podium. But I think a lot of Ferrari's performance at the moment has to be, or is being viewed through the sort of contrasting filter of McLaren as well. Last year, Ferrari were in a bit of a sort of league of their own in sort of a no man's land between Red Bull, and then it was sort of Ferrari, then you sort of had McLaren, Mercedes, Aston Martin sort of fumbling around behind them. This year, McLaren have stepped up and caught up with them. And all of a sudden, if we aren't seeing Ferrari ahead of them, we're starting to sort of nitpick and look for those problems, as opposed to simply just accepting, oh yeah, McLaren are actually just dead quick now.
It's kind of a nice problem to have of whenever Mercedes were not, during their hype, whenever they went on their A game, it's like, what the hell are you doing in third place? Mm. Is this kind of, it's a great problem to have.
Yeah, we've now sort of got that thing where, as a fan of the sport, regardless of whether you're a sort of Tifosi or if you're a Red Bull fan, as a fan of the sport, you've got two teams locked in battle for second place, admittedly, but I mean, with the performance Perez is putting in, that battle for second place might become a battle for first place if you've got both Ferrari drivers and both McLaren drivers up there interesting, puking out.
It's that interesting thing now of, if you take the top five teams, you've got a divisive driver lineup with Verstappen and Perez, where one is clearly better than the other. McLaren and Ferrari have a strong driver lineup, very strong, and very strong cars, but not quite to the same level as Red Bull, but the driver makes up for that. And Mercedes have two very strong drivers, but don't have the car for it. And Aston Martin have this weird thing of the best and worst of all of that, in terms of the car isn't terrible, but it's not brilliant. And you've got one driver who is excellent, but the other one is not. And they're still able to somehow maintain that solid middle ground there. And kind of, if there is an opportunity, Alonso will be the one to take that. So it's getting closer. And like I said earlier, if this is not a one-off, then I'm all there for it. But I don't dare to hope just yet.
Yeah, like, it's a bit weird looking at the constructor spread at the moment. 268 points for Red Bull.
It looks a lot worse than it is, I feel like.
Yeah, 212 for Ferrari, and then McLaren 154. So there's just over 100-point spread at the top, which feels huge at this point in time, but I think we're going to see that close up, actually. And
especially if you have a couple more mechanical DNFs in there for something like Red Bull or Ferrari or McLaren, then it just allows, and who cares about merit at this point, Mercedes and Aston Martin just to close that gap. Doesn't necessarily mean overtake, but just close the gap and put the pressure on a bit more, just to see what those top teams will do in terms of absorbing it or dealing with it in some way, or just absolutely shitting the bed and panicking.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I mean, even when you look at the drivers' battle, yes, Verstappen storming way into the lead, but this weekend we saw Leclerc overtake Perez, we saw Norris overtake Sainz, and they'd been on tied points after Miami. So there's a really interesting battle going on in the top sort of five, if you're ignoring the battle for first, which is non-existent. And it's great to see that actually starting to come through, and it's providing an interesting season as an F1 fan. It's a bit trickier to enjoy if you're anything but a Red Bull fan, but yeah, it's nice. And I think Monaco and Canada for Ferrari are going to be interesting. They're very much going to be sort of the litmus test papers for sort of whether or not the upgrades they've brought along work against what McLaren have done. And equally, when it comes to sort of settling down the new team structures, getting the new patterns working. And equally, it's going to be sort of one of the first times we start seeing sort of the performance directors they've brought in sort of start making some adjustments, as well as deputy team principals. So there's some interesting moves we're going to see there as to what happens.
Would you like to know a useless fact that is no longer a fact that will help lead into Mercedes?
I love a useless fact. Go on, hit me with it.
If Mercedes had won this weekend in Imola for their 300th Grand Prix, it would have been the first time since 2021 that we would have had three consecutive races with three different teams winning. And last time, it would also have been Red Bull, McLaren, Mercedes, because it would have been Zandvoort, Monza, and Russia with Verstappen, Ricciardo, and Hamilton. But that didn't happen, so I can't really do much with this, but I'm saying it anyway. because instead Mercedes are in no man's land, as per usual at the moment.
Yeah, very good fact. But yeah, it does lead us nicely into Mercedes. I've not really got a huge amount to say on them, but I do have something to say counter to your point. So they're sort of still very much struggling to understand their car. That I think they're getting there with understanding their car. That doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be any quicker, though. They predicted they'd be sixth and seventh, and they got that prediction correct. So they sort of know what it's up to. They just also know that it's bad. They haven't yet figured out how to make it quicker. But Timo, you've got a bit more to say, and I've got sort of a rebuttal for it as well.
Well, look, to rebuttal your rebuttal before you get the chance to rebuttal it, I'm going to clarify my initial point there of I was questioning why towards the end of the race they were pitting Russell over Hamilton. And that's where the risk came into play, because I think there was the argument I think that Russell was making of why don't you pit Hamilton? And it's like, well, because there's more of a chance that he'll come out behind Perez, and while he'll still probably get ahead of him, there's less chance of it if we pit you and you go for fastest lap. So for the team overall, you'll still get the same amount of points plus one, and you're already ahead of Lewis anyway, I think, in the driver standings at the moment. So that doesn't matter too much. And also, considering where you both are in the driver standings, who gives a shit where you're finishing at the moment? You're not first, second, or third, so no one's going to remember anyway, apart from people like us, when we want to find some interesting facts to go on about. So I found it interesting, but because it seemed kind of curious at the time, why risk it for fastest lap? But then I think it's one of those things where, because of the gap isn't massive to Aston Martin, I think that's why it's not big enough for them to be resting a lot on these points. They come in handy, and like I said earlier, if you have some mechanical DNFs coming to play for the teams ahead of them, who knows how much of a difference one or two points can make. And when you see how much a team like Haas and RB celebrate over one or two points, it's weird to see Mercedes then going for, you know what, you guys might be onto something.
Playing it point by point. And yeah, I think you're right with sort of your rebuttal and possibly sort of clarity of hindsight, sort of thinking about the race afterwards. There was obviously logic to pitting Russell. You're getting the same points as a team, but also Russell had that gap ahead of Hamilton to not worry about falling back into Perez on pit exit. And yeah, you're right. Again, Russell sacrificed 1 point, but he still leads Lewis by 9 overall. Yeah, it's an interesting one that Mercedes is sort of having to make those sort of banker points now, because like you said, if there is a chaotic race coming through, we know a driver that's likely to sort of capitalize on that, and his name is Fernando Alonso. Like, it's not
out of Lewis Hamilton, no, but yes.
It's not out of the ordinary to expect that the relatively reliably running Aston Martin in a crazy race would sort of pop in a P2 or a P3, and all of a sudden that's Aston Martin closed right up to the back of Mercedes again in the standings, and that could be a problem for them come sort of season's end. They'd be beaten by two customer teams. They're currently being beaten very sort of,
and I think you feel Mercedes, you don't mind as much if it's McLaren, because there's all this history to it, whereas Aston Martin, it's had so many different faces, it could be a good audition piece for Doctor Who at this point. Whereas McLaren's has been consistent, so you kind of accept it if they do, because they have, you're kind of happy to see them over the best of mine still fresh in this new era. And you're just like, well, you can't be doing this, so we've got to make sure we at least beat this lot, especially when Stroll's part of that team.
Yeah, McLaren doesn't upset the boat. You look at McLaren's engineering and development department, and it sort of dwarfs the size of most sort of Fortune 500 businesses. And you look at Aston Martin, and it's maybe sort of five hopeful men with a sketchbook, and it's very different. You don't want to be by the five when hopeful men with a sketchbook.
He's not. Work harder.
I'm not paying you for this. Anyway. Yeah, so that's roughly where Mercedes stands. We've already mentioned McLaren. And yeah, Timo, I'll let you lead with yours because it's a bit shorter than mine.
Yeah, because you're going to talk about one driver and then talk about the other, because I would have just loved to have seen what Piastri could have done if he'd actually been in P2, because Ted Travis was saying he was the quickest driver, really, because he was just doing it on his own.
Yeah.
And he wasn't getting a toe or anything. And his time is coming. It's got to be soon, because this, look what he can do when he's got the upgrades. I think Norris is not going to be worried about him just yet, because he's still on that confidence high. But I think maybe this is not going to be my ball prediction for today's episode. Piastri wins Silverstone and Norris has a sudden reality check because he beats Norris too. Maybe Norris finishes P2, but it's like it could have been you at your home race. But your teammate in his second season beat you to this thing that you were most capable of getting this year. And you've got to wait at least another 12 months, and who knows what the team's going to be like then. And that's going to be his first win. And it would just be really nice, sort of, not quite fuck you, because it's still his team and it's still nice and everything. He's got a long future there, hopefully. But after having to sacrifice in Australia for position and then having to not deal with getting the upgrade to Miami and seeing Norris win and then having this kind of annoying penalty on top of it, as well as saying he was quite bored with this race because the DRS zone was too short and being so frustrated for so long behind Sainz, it was, I think it would be some nice counter storytelling there. And it's just, we know how good he is. See, and it would just be, I really wanted to get that realization. I don't want to wait 110 races.
Yeah, I want Piastri to do it. And I'm either going to be bolder than you and say it's Canada, which I've sort of already hinted at this episode.
I don't mind if it's, I don't mind if that's his first one. I just really like the idea of him winning Silverstone instead of Lando, just because of the mind games that will then trigger.
I'd like for him to do it at a circuit where he pulls out of his arse another one of his sort of like, I'm 1/34th this nationality, because he did it going into Italy. He obviously did it for Australia. He sort of did it for China as well. Somehow he sort of rootled through ancestry.com and found a Chinese.
His mum's really bored at home. She's just doing all this research. Yeah. So I'm like, can you use this in something?
Yeah.
I'll see what I can do.
Because he jokingly tweeted earlier today, checking the family ancestry to see if I'm any part Monegasque. But I think Canada would be an interesting one. I think there's an opportunity there for him. Equally, Austria. I have a weird thing.
Because Lando loves Austria and he's done well there before. So if he didn't win, but he just beat Lando there and then win Silverstone, you're like, that could be fun. Because imagine this team is now in this position to necessarily challenge Red Bull for the championship, but really close that gap. And what lets them down is this sudden infighting between them, because there's this kind of, Zach Brown's clearly very much into Lando and everything, but Piastri then just decides, I'll just do it myself.
Similar
how
to
then plays into it.
Alonso Hamilton at McLaren in 2007?
Seven.
Correct, yeah. When you had that sort of clear favouritism between the team and sort of the infighting that spun from it, it's, yeah, I'm basically going to stake my bets here. It's either going to be Canada or Austria. We see it. I'd like to see it at Hungary because I'll be there to see it. And it'd be great to do that. But we'll wait and see. But yeah, I think when it comes to McLaren, the upgrades and the tweaks are proving valuable. Both drivers are proving to be super quick all weekend. And the unfortunate penalty for Piastri blocking on a narrow track, we've already mentioned that. But yeah, like you said, he was arguably the quickest driver overall through qualifying. He didn't have a toe setting his qualifying lap time. Max did. He wouldn't sort of... Somehow Nico Hülkenberg had been working in cahoots to tow one another through the session. Which...
Give me that Red Bull seat. I can still get out of my Audi contract.
Do you imagine Nico Hülkenberg, 2025 world champion with Red Bull? What a change.
And then become uncompetitive in 2026 and no one gets it for another 10 years with Red Bull.
Yeah, that'd be such Nico Hülkenberg luck, weirdly. But anyway, yeah, it was an interesting weekend from McLaren. Great launch from Norris, but then lost out in the second phase of the start with a little bit of secondary wheel spin as the sort of second wave of power comes through. Great recovery of the tyres, though, while pushing late against Max and sort of let them come back to him and then used it to close right up. It was a really good piece of racecraft and sort of understanding his car. I think there's, again, still a really good communication between him and his engineer, Will Joseph. You sort of heard him sort of jokingly respond to him, or sort of Will saying sort of, this is one of the corners you can push on and sort of utilize the exit a bit more on. This is where he's got more exit speed. And Lando goes, I'm already pushing. Thank you. Like, he's still, he's thinking, he's got the communication. He's working with the team around him. And it's really good to see a driver that's operating on that level. And everyone likes to sort of dismiss Lando for being the sort of the jokey one, the unserious one, the one that sort of goes out and gets drunk and falls over barges in the Netherlands with Martin Garrix. But when you see the performances like that on circuit, you see the level he's operating at, it sort of recertifies just what he's able
it's
to do in this
kind
series.
Of doing what I was hoping it would be, and showing that he isn't just satisfied with that one win. And he's going to keep pushing for it, which we're kind of worried about, because sometimes that happens a little bit, or you think, oh, he's going to settle for P2 here, and then he closed up and he didn't get it, and that's perfectly fine. I just want to see him trying. And I think that, for me, for whatever reason, has been missing up until Miami. And you saw that with the gulfs in gaps to whoever's in front of him. And it's just nice to see that, regardless of what you think of him as a driver or as a person, the fact that that's now coming to the surface is just good, and it's good for the sport.
It's great for the sport, seeing him sort of off track, he's very much sort of got a modern prototype of sort of the James Hunt personality of sort of a bit of a wild party boy and enjoys going out a bit.
No one's going to be James Hunt, though.
A modern version thereof, possibly died.
Because you're James Hunt old now,
yeah,
otherwise.
Almost certainly. But the fact that he has that duality of nature and the fact that he still takes what he's doing so seriously and is able to produce such a high level of performance is really good. And yeah, like you said, I think that's great for the sport to have that sort of that optic of it as well, which is superb. Meanwhile, the other Mercedes, one of the other Mercedes customer teams, Aston Martin.
Yeah, I've kind of written here, Alonso's taking one for the team with the test this weekend because he had a lot of trouble and he kind of sacrificed himself, like kind of like he did early on in the season, of choosing his battle with YSD and deciding where he's going to try. And as soon as he realized that this was not going to go his way this weekend, he just kind of resigned himself to, well, what are these upgrades? Let's try a bit of everything and see what happens. And if we've got to retire, then we've got to retire. It's not going to be too big a deal. Stroll, meanwhile, he made some good moves, which was interesting to see because we're so unused to it. It was a little bit like in Japan. But it is the bare minimum we expect from a driver in his 150th race, which if you saw any of the posts for that, you go and look at the comments, they were excellent. And just replace him already. It's kind of, this is what you should at least be doing every Grand Prix, and the fact that it's happened in two races this year out of seven.
Yeah. The Stroll one's an interesting one, and 150 races, we've not seen a great deal from him. Certainly in F1.
One pole position and a slew of podiums, that's about it.
Yeah.
And some of the time it was more because of the craziness of the racing rather than anything from skill, if we're going to be harsh about it.
Yeah, and then you sort of go back to his time in like F3 and everyone goes, oh, well, what about this? What about this? What about this? And you sort of look at the...
Well, to put a dagger in your heart on that one, Giovinazzi was great in F3 and look what happened there.
He went on to win Le Mans at least. But no, I'm not backing up Stroll for his F3 forwards.
No, but actually, you know what I'm saying? It's like you can only go back so far and go, yeah, you may have been great here. I mean, you're going to be great here.
But arguably, yes, he won F3. But did he? Is the question that I sort of want people to actually go away and look into. Because one, have a look at his race start against Charles Leclerc at Zandvoort. The fact that he just drove Charles Leclerc into the pit wall in the middle of the pack. Weird move. When he crashed into his teammate and another car at the top of the Kemmel Straight in Spa. Weird move. No spatial awareness. And then he did something similar where he drove into the back of a car in Monza and then had that horrendous crash where he sort of barrel rolled several times into the fence. Very strange move. But yeah, and then you also look at what Lawrence Stroll was doing with regards, because I think he was racing for Prema at the time. And obviously early on, Lawrence had his links with Williams and there were maybe Williams engineers at the F3 races fettling with his car. And maybe there was this one time they might have fitted some different parts to his front suspension. Go have a read up about it. It's all very interesting. And yeah.
You may very well say that I couldn't possibly comment.
All I'm saying is do your own research, which is a sketchy thing to say on podcast when it's just two white guys talking to each other. Go do your own research. But you look back on his history and George Russell raised this. He said it's unfair trying to fight Lance Stroll in Formula 3 because you're fighting with one hand tied behind your back because you, A, don't have the development on your car in a spec series, which you shouldn't have. Mm. And also the fact, if you go back and watch the first four laps, I want to say, of the French round of the Formula 3 season when Lance was racing in it, you'll notice that his teammate gets him off the line, leads into the first lap, and going into the second lap, Lance just somehow gets a really good drive onto the Mistral straight at Le Castellet and his teammate just sort of lets him past. And you might start to see George Russell's argument there. It's an interesting one. And this is now a driver that's getting up to 150 race starts. There's nothing truly atrocious about him. He's not Nikita Mazepin bad. But considering the talent that's
coming... There's nothing that great about him either.
Yeah, considering the talent that's come through Formula 2 in the time since that hasn't made it to F1. Including champions. Look at the drivers that are going off into IndyCar at the moment that we're seeing perform fantastically. Your likes of your Callum Ilots, your Marcus Armstrongs. The drivers that really could have done with a good seat going into F1 and looking at what Aston Martin have been able to do the past 2 years at least with a decent car, you feel a sort of bit ambiguous about Lance Stroll. Overall, the upgrades the team brought this weekend were a bit of a meh. It was a shocker of a weekend from Alonso. hard to really tell their overall performance, as Stroll's result comes as a bit of an outlier. His average finish position this year is 11.9, so a P9 is a bit out
there. Close, but no cigar.
Yeah.
But his happy news, though, with Minardi, because they kind of outperformed their car again in both respects. Yuki definitely did, and he's very much dialed into both this track in particular, as we saw in 2022, but also this weekend. And Ricciardo definitely has an improvement weekend. I think that's another one of those curious cases of, I want to know what his strategy was meant to achieve, because it wasn't incredibly clear, because he was only a couple of places behind Yuki from the start, but then he was weirdly battling Hulk, and you would have thought they would have tried something a little bit more interesting to get him ahead of him. But this being said, I think it's still the case of the cars not working perfectly. And this is for both drivers, because, I mean, if you look at their race starts, they did not do well there. And that was for both of them. So I think whilst Yuki definitely more dialed in with it, the fact that he had that issue shows that it's not just a simple case of one driver is better than the other. It's this, they're still very much learning, but they're developing it. And I think the fact that Ricciardo outdid Perez in qualifying, and you kind of, I saw him in P10 at the end of Q2. I'm like, oh no, we're going to have another situation where he's so close and doesn't do it, and then Perez can't do it. I'm like, my word, Ricciardo has just absolutely trounced him here. It's quite nice to see, because with Yuki, we're kind of used to seeing this nice performance from him now. It's kind of 4 years the charm in a way, but it's nice that it's happening finally, because this is a driver where he himself has said before he's surprised that he keeps getting contract renewed. And so the fact that he's improving and taking it seriously and it's finally working away is nice to see. And I think that despite the P13, I think it was for Ricciardo, it's still better than it looks on paper, and you've really got to dive into the details for it. And outdoing a Red Bull is no mean feat, especially when this is a car that arguably, I mean, they're behind Aston Martin in the championship by a good country mile. That should tell you everything you need to know.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. On the Ricciardo strategy, I think what they were trying to do was essentially pitting Ricciardo to force Haas to play their hand with Hülkenberg, and that would then give Yuki a chance to sort of open up and up a gap and pit into free air. And admittedly, it just about worked. It relied a huge amount on Yuki going a bit balls to the wall and really chucking that car around the circuit to open up the gap.
It worked for one of them, but it didn't work for the other.
Ricciardo was essentially a pawn used to try and sort of lure out a bishop or a rook at that point. It was a tactical play, and it was a good play for the team. But ultimately, Ricciardo sort of recovered his drive well, and I'll give him that.
And this is why I'm quite interested, because Monaco is obviously very qualifying beneficial for the race. That's all I'm saying. We can get more into the preview for Monaco, but you can see where I'm going with that.
Yeah, if we get Ricciardo
and a nice qualifying
Perez, there's going to be an interesting battle there and an interesting strategy battle. Maybe they'll do the other way around. Maybe they won't. Maybe
again, to go back to what we were saying earlier with the top five teams, this is a strong driver lineup in a car that is not there, but they seem to be extracting the most out of it. If you're Aston Martin, maybe if they can get a few more double points finished between now and the summer break, it's time to get a little worried. There's still a decent gap, but how long does it take to close that if Aston Martin have a couple of tough weekends and RB are just consistent?
It's only 24 points between them. So
Ricciardo's won at Monaco before. He wins that race, gets fastest lap. There we go, job done.
I mean, even then, like, it's a couple of, like, four-pointers. What's 4 points? It's P8, isn't it?
It's
a P8 and a P7.
And let's face it, it's only Alonso you're fighting, really.
Yeah, you could easily start to close that gap. And I think Aston Martin really ought to be worried about the sort of RB behind them, because it is getting quick. And equally, Tsunoda cooking all weekend, properly on form with his head in the game, didn't make things easy for the drivers around him. And Ricciardo, we've already said, is getting closer. And there's still a little bit of something missing from the car, and possibly a little bit of something missing from Ricciardo. But nice to see Tsunoda not just letting people past when there was a slightly quicker car behind him. And I like that. Certainly when Perez was fighting his way through the first time round, Tsunoda was getting his elbows out. It wasn't an easy move for Perez to get past. Tsunoda was like, that's my seat next year. Watch it, sunshine. I think that it's interesting. more interesting.
Bit of the episode now where this is going to be quite quick to get through.
Yeah, more interesting than Williams, which was a rough, rough weekend. They need to sort the car out soon because they are getting left behind in the standings overall. And it's a shame, really, for Albon with that wheel issue. It seems to be more intrinsic than a bad wheel nut. I think there might have been a balance issue with the wheel, something vibrating that would suggest it was coming out loose, because obviously the wheel guns now, unlike in Formula 2, do tell you when a wheel's on tight, and that's what gives the car the release to go. So it's strange that something sort of went wrong there more mechanically, but yeah, strange.
Regardless, the only good thing I've got to say is kudos to Albon for his driving, because if that tire was not properly and it was coming loose, he did the absolute perfect way to keep it on there, because we've seen how you can just accelerate even just a small bit in the wrong place on a track and that screws up everything you've done to try and keep it on up to that point. So the fact that maybe it wouldn't have come off anyway, but you've got to drive as if it's going to, and the fact that he managed to do this and just get everything right to not tempt that to happen.
It was a very safe, very mature drive from Albon. If you actually did, you see the moment where he was coming up to, I want to say, Acqua Minerale, the chicane at the top of the track, and he was hanging back, lets one battle go through, nips through, and gets out the way so the next battle can get through.
Like, that was the bit where I was like, I need to make a note of this. That's
really, really good awareness from Albon. Decent from Sargeant as well. Credit where it's due. He put up some fights with a lot of faster cars around him. Didn't make things easy for them, but ultimately I think they were coming past regardless. That car wasn't able to hang on to its tyres, and it just isn't quick enough. It doesn't have the sort of mechanical grip to sort of produce the advantage that a driver needs to win in a sort of head-to-head fight. Moving on to Sauber.
I have two notes. One is, I still like the livery, but also, fuck a duck.
A bit spicy this weekend. There was a bit more performance, but not a lot of progress. Like, we're talking small margins, and they're still fighting.
Spicy is in my bowels notice that there's something slightly hot in this food, but I'm not sure I like it.
It's sort of like having a well-done korma, more so than anything else. Yeah. Tricky to say anything about
Haas,
steak.
However,
there is actually something to say about Haas.
Yeah. You can talk about Hulk, but K-Mag kept out of danger, so that was good. But he still had some fun against Joe, where he was thinking about it, and then you could probably see in the driver, like, oh, no, hang on a minute, I'm close to a race ban, I should probably behave slightly. Sod it, I'll just go for this move anyway, and just see, I can do it and be clean. So it was nice to see that, but he's also possibly in the danger zone a little bit from what we were talking about earlier. But Hulk, to lead into you there, he needs Audi to be good, because, man, oh, man, he is driving so gosh darn well.
Yeah, Magnussen elbows out cleanly for once, which is good to see. And Hülkenberg imbuing his inner Senna at points across the weekend. If the Audi is decent, he could be a real threat next season. Equally, if I'm him, I'm checking that contract and sort of having a look in the door of the Red Bull office every time I walk past.
I want him to have a Kimi Räikkönen-style Lotus contract where for every point he gets $30,000 and he bankrupts Audi.
That would be hilarious, because equally what it will do is also start really making Volkswagen sort of regret trying to ever get into F1, because one German guy just outwits them and just bankrupts
them. We were worried about Vettel and Schumacher. We should have been worried about Hulk. It comes back to the Thor Ragnarok meme of... You can't stop me. I know, but he can.
He can, yeah. Oh, that I wonder if anyone's on that sort of a contract at the moment. Like, I doubt it.
No, knowing their luck, it's probably the Alpine boys.
Yeah, that's great, because Ocon has got an extra £30,000. Great. But that probably means very little in the grand scheme of things. That's about it at the moment. Speaking of Alpine, they were in this Grand Prix.
Mm-hmm. Better, but still, Jesus Christ. It's kind of, P14. Oh, who cares? It's still really quite bad for a team that was on the podium twice last year, three times if you include a sprint race.
Yeah.
Which I don't, but still.
You don't, but ultimately it was still points that Gasly got. Gasly got to the podium there, he'll count it. But yeah, it was just steps forward, and they were jostling with other teams a bit, but again, a bit like steak, you're fighting for nothing at this point in time. Like, I want more from you, please. Anyway, drivers we've seen plenty from and are happy with, our winners as we go into winners and spinners. Timo, yours.
Well, it's pretty self-explanatory what we said earlier, but Max Verstappen, just it was nice to see him win a race that he had to fight for. And it's this sort of thing of, I don't know if I've said it here before on the podcast, I've definitely said it to lots of people, but I genuinely don't mind if he wins. I just really want to see him fight for it more. It was kind of like 2021 where, okay, he won that race, but you know he had to really fight for it every single time because Lewis was right there. And this is the first time we've got it since at least 2022, because let's look at the races he's not won lately. Miami, not much he could do there. And the safety car very much helped Lando. Singapore, he was absolutely nowhere. And then I think you've got to go back as far as what, maybe Baku and Saudi of last year when Perez was winning, perhaps, to see that. But even then, it wasn't really much of a fight in the grand scheme of things. It was just, this is the luck of the draw. It wasn't like a really intense thing of anything. Although it was like, there weren't serious problems, but there weren't big competition either. So you've got to go back until like the start of 2022, like we were saying earlier, with Saudi Arabia with Charles and these sorts of races to find this. And that's not good. So I like that it reinforces that brutality of him as a driver. And like I say, that shows why he's still here, because he hopes, and you can tell that from what he says, that he enjoys the other teams coming out there, because we saw in China, he gets bored if it's just him out there on his own and he wants to do other things. He wants to try the bits and pieces because that's the only way to keep it interesting. And he wouldn't mind if he lost those races because of something he did, because it gives him something different to fight for next time. Like, if no one's going to fight me, and I'm making a mistake because I decided to do a donut because I'm 40 seconds ahead before I cross the line, and then I lose, well, now I've got to try and get 50 seconds so I can do that donut at the end and then go across the line and still win. Or do what I did on the F1 2009 game, get a nice lead, and then reverse over the finish line.
Mm. There is one person that's happier than sort of like Oscar and Lando for McLaren making a step forwards, and that's Max, because he's got someone to play with on circuit now. Like, he's not on his own, which is great. For me, though, my winner has to be Lando. He obviously didn't win the Grand Prix second this week, but he brought the fight to an intact Red Bull as well. This is a Red Bull that wasn't really suffering. It wasn't suffering the issues it might have been in Miami, and really showed his hand. Like, it's a case of, yeah, Lando could do this again. And especially when it came to keeping Leclerc at bay as well, keeping his tyres alive in that sort of very boring sort of third quarter of the race.
Just know Leclerc was just praying for them to take each other out.
Well, if you saw them in the cooldown room afterwards, when Hamilton went off and hit the gravel, they were all sort of hoping it was one of the other ones that they were fighting against, going, I was hoping that was you. I thought that was you. If you've made Max fight for a win, you've done very well indeed, given the form Max is on and the car he's got at the moment. So if you've been able to push him to that limit, that is fantastic for me. Spinners, though, other side of the coin, Timo?
Well, it has to be. I mean, there are so many people that have chosen, but it's just, again, this driver who just doesn't seems to be loving everything in life except, he seems to be loving Formula 1 for all the wrong reasons, because he's not taking it seriously enough, and it feels like he's just still just occupying a seat. And when you're getting overtaken by Stroll, I don't care if he's in a better car than you're getting overtaken by Stroll, you're Bottas, you've won Grand Prix. You've fought for championships. And yes, you may be in a terrible car this year, but come on.
Yeah, you're sort of expecting a bit of the skill to come out here and sort of undo a bit of how bad the car is. But
get my stick out and poke him. Come on, do something.
Or maybe the stake just is that bad.
Either way, he's my spinner. Better.
Mine is Perez, for much the same reasons of do better, with Yuki looking so strong and Max doing this as his hobby alongside racing. If you saw any of the footage from him doing the 24-hour race, his team were joking that sort of this is what Max does as his day job, and they like to let their sort of team members go off and enjoy themselves in sort of regional series and the rest of motorsport, sort of joking about it. But like, Max looking so dominant, even when pushed to the limit by Lando. Meanwhile, you've got Perez fighting for his life in the bottom third of the points. Mm. And Yuki looking strong against him. Daniel getting to look more and more at home in that car. This was quite a second-tier weekend for the Mexican. And yeah, I would be concerned.
It's kind of like Ricardo landed the first punch and then Yuki finished him off with finishing ahead of him there.
Yeah, not great. But anyway,
not great.
Yeah, our predictions. Only point scorers are Ellie Mae and my girlfriend Georgia, neither of whom are actually here. Ellie Mae is just getting back from her holiday, and Georgia is back at her house. So yeah, it's just you and I to sit here in the glory of Ellie Mae banking 2 points with Verstappen on pole and winning, which feels like too much of an obvious choice. We should force her to pick differently. And Georgia at least got one for Lando P2, so credit to her for actually picking something a bit inventive.
I was nearly there, though, because I had Oscar for P2, and if he had kept his bloody second place for qualifying, he might have been in P2. So I'm getting closer, I feel like. I feel like I'm Alpine. I've made a step forward, but I don't know what it means.
No, you had Piastri to win, I'm afraid.
Well, it still might have happened if he'd been in second place, because I still think with that upgraded McLaren, he could have gone, and maybe he would have had that extra... He would have started hunting Max down sooner or he would have got him. Either way, kind of reinforcing my point there, I'm like Alpine. I've made a step forward, but I don't know what it means. I don't know what I'll do with it.
Anyway, we'll move on from our predictions to our F1 Fantasy League, and a quick review here where the highest scorer this week was Max Verstappen with Trabant Formula 1 and a tidy 195 points. I was the highest scorer out of the three of us with my mid-beds racing team in 8th out of, and generally very mixed results throughout the board there. Quite a low scoring weekend it felt like as well, which is quite interesting. Overall, Noah Honga still leads, and I'm the highest of any of us now, overtaking Ellie Mae for 13th. So she's not here
enjoy
to win the battle.
It won't be for long.
Yeah, she'll probably come back. She'll do something. We don't know. But anyway, that's all we've got for this week's episode.
It's more than I thought we would.
Yeah, there was a surprise about to talk about in a race where surprisingly not a lot happened. But there were some good performances from drivers in there. In the meantime, Timo, where can the people find you?
You can find me over on the Curbs, the Nigel Irish podcast, Paddock's Ferrari, Across the Pond Sport Network, IndyCar podcast, and Is It Fast? And that should do for now. As well as social media, because that's a few things to get you busy in dealing with, and there's plenty of content across all of those million different outlets.
Plenty to keep you occupied, especially as we go into Indy 500 week as well.
Yeah, we've got a lot. We've got a podcast solely on qualifying. This is how intense Indy is in the month of May.
Well, it just sort of, Indy 500 starts on the 1st of May and pretty much finishes on the sort of Sunday at the end of it. It's like a month of just going fast and turning left, which is incredible. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the meantime, if you want to find more from me, you can find me writing for Classic Car Weekly. Our latest issue will be out not long after this podcast goes live, I should think. It'll be out on the Wednesday on shop shelves. We're looking back at Dodge Chargers on screen across the years as it celebrates an anniversary, I believe. And on Wednesday, I'm off to go and drive some more interesting cars. I think we've got an MGA to test drive. So I'm looking forward to that, although it's probably going to be raining. So we'll see how that goes. Anyway, I'm also on social media at Jesse on Cars on Instagram, TikTok, Twitter. I was about to say LinkedIn. I don't really post on LinkedIn.
You're not Jesse on Cars on LinkedIn anyway. You're just Jesse B.
Just Jesse Billington on LinkedIn. But anyway, thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you again soon for a preview of the Monaco Grand Prix. Correct? Yes.